Tim, how was the Blue Angels?
It was amazing. I'm going to give a big shout out to John. He really hooked it up for the family and the kids. It's going to be a core memory. It's nice. So thank you.
Made it through the gate and everything all right? Made the show on time?
Yep. I could have been smarter and like went through the non-public gate where the traffic was or wasn't.
You mean where he told you to go?
I just used Google Maps.
All right, welcome to the pod. We're live, episode 18. We've got the gang back together. The first time since episode 13, which was more than a while ago. So probably back in the summer, I think June. My bad, I suck. We have a docket full of news and happenings today, so we're just going to get right to it. First up, we're going to talk about the Middle East, which is tenuous. Disclaimer, by the time this hits, something is going to change. And disclaimer two is that we're probably not experts on every single thing we're about to talk about, but we're going to try to explain what's going on and kind of our thoughts. So if you get offended or Tim cancels himself out in the first like 5 minutes, then that's what happened.
This is definitely a topic that could get us canceled. For sure.
This is probably one of the topics. Yeah. All right. But we'll go for it. Okay. So as we're recording this, it's been about 3 weeks almost since Hamas launched a coordinated attack across the Gaza Strip into Israel. And so here we are 3 weeks later. We thought that there was going to be a ground invasion that was imminent. It was not so imminent. However, as we were going to recording, it seems like overnight they have launched a incursion with some tanks across the border. And that's kind of where we're at right now. So now that some time has passed, and I haven't really talked about it in the newsletter at all, as I try not to talk about current events because I don't want to get drug into the hype cycle of news. There's plenty of people on Twitter that do that already. So instead, I wanted to let it lay low a little bit and kind of make sense after a while. And I'm glad it did. All right. So the first one is why they attacked. How did they do it? And then what did they attack and why? And that's really kind of the things that are probably worth talking about at this stage. And then we can obviously talk about the response after that. All right. So you want to play spin the bottle or who wants to go first?
I'll just throw it out there. Why not?
Okay.
I think it was kind of ironic that that the attack happened right after all the Ukraine funding got canceled and the speaker got removed. Right now we have a new war that we can't refuse to support. Thoughts?
Are you pitching that as a conspiracy theory or?
It sounds more like conspiracy theory than.
There's a lot of conspiracy in there. Okay, yeah, there is some interesting. The timing of it's interesting. I will say that there's a couple of things. We'll get into that in just a little bit.
Okay.
That
probably wasn't where they attacked.
We can get to that. obviously, like why they did that is a generations long discussion of how things got to where they're at between Palestine and Israel, which we don't want to get drug into that conversation today. But if you guys are, it goes back to the late 40s, basically, and there's a whole bunch of history behind it. But where we care about for the purposes of this discussion is in 2005, there was a deal made between Israel and the Palestinians. And the deal was that Israel would vacate the Gaza Strip. And so they took, they had 8,000 people in 21 settlements that were all living in the Gaza Strip. And they struck a deal, dismantled those settlements and relocated all of those Israelis out of the Gaza Strip and said, you have this, we have that. It was part of what they call a disengagement plan. They were completely disengaging from the Gaza Strip. There's going to be peace in the Middle East. But there's the but. They ended up maintaining control over their air, the maritime space kind of off the coast, almost all of the land crossings, and then they built a kind of a buffer zone, which is their border around the Gaza Strip. And then they had a population registry to actually keep track of who came into the Gaza Strip, who left. And then they have some water and, you know, telecommunications, electricity, and other stuff that they were kind of making the Gaza Strip depending on Israel for. some of that stuff's changed a little bit over since then, but that's kind of how the conditions were set. And if you guys remember, Arafat, he was the one that was trying to negotiate that. And he was part of a faction called the,
is it not the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization?
It was a political branch off of that, but that's what they were representing. So he ended up dying in 2004, right as all this stuff was happening. And so what happened was, I would say, again, not an expert, a power vacuum. So he dies, his political party that he's representing kind of falls into disarray with a lot of infighting. And then that kind of gave rise to another party, which was Hamas, who was fighting with them over power. And Hamas ended up getting elected into government. So this is all happening between 2004 and 2006. So a terrorist organization was elected to fill this power vacuum in Gaza, with basically no insights from Israel, besides their intelligence and spy collection, but no overt insights. And so that kind of set the conditions of this crackdown. And the Palestinian territory, it's interesting because it's a state of Palestine recognized by the UN, but it's not a state recognized by the EU. It's a territory, and Israel calls it a disputed territory. So it's a really weird situation. All goes back to blaming Britain for drawing lines on a map at the end of World War II. But that's kind of what set those conditions. And if you look at the sanctions and retaliatory strikes, I think it was 2013, 2014, there's been skirmishes along the border. I would surmise that you can go into Iran and Hezbollah if you want, but the humanitarian conditions are probably some of the things that led them to attack. And how they attacked, I think, is probably a strategic mistake based on their choice to not attack the IDF, but to attack the civilian, whether the concert or some of the neighborhoods. And they took hostages. So basically acting like terrorists, which is probably not a good thing when you look at the response from, like, what is the global response reaction to that? Not good, turns out.
This goes back way longer than 70 years. Right? I mean, it goes back 3,000 years. Or it's the strip of land, Israel itself, is one of the most disputed or fought over, like, strips of land in, I guess this would be modern and pre-modern history. There's a great little cartoon video that goes back, I think, to about 1000 BC or 2000 BC and shows how many times the strip of land has changed hands and who's had control over it. So when people say we want our land back, the question is, like, where do you freeze history, right? Like, in theory, you give the whole thing back to Egypt. Gaza itself was Egyptian until, what, 1960-something or other?
67, I believe.
Right, and the Israelis seized it. So anyway, I mean, the history goes back a lot longer than just the current conflict. You're right, it was a strategic mistake in the way that Hamas attacked Israel. I mean, if Hamas had just launched rockets at IDF targets and not left the borders of Gaza, I think Israel would have zero international support for what they're doing today, right? Like a ground invasion or the bombing of Palestine. But that's not what Hamas did. Hamas invaded, attacked civilians. It didn't just attack civilians, right? But attacked civilians in pretty horrific ways, according to the reports that have come out of Israel. So not just attacking innocent people, but doing it in ways that are particularly barbaric or stand out a lot in the sort of modern mind.
No, that totally makes sense. They're acting like, you know, you act like terrorists. So you're doing things to elicit fear in a population, even if you're not strong enough to, you know, potentially like fight the IDF. Which is not a small force, but you can wreak havoc across the population. And there was a strategy behind that. Of course, it could backfire, which I think it did. Have you guys ever been to Israel?
I have. I've flown into Ben Gurion Airport before, whenever I was deployed. But I mean, nothing like for commercial travel or for vacations or anything.
I've been there, I think, 4 times. At least 3, I think 4, in a military capacity, doing various things at the tactical level, operational level, and then some strategic, like, national security fellowship stuff. Very fascinating country. When you spend enough time there, you kind of you understand their plight and their situation. You know, they're surrounded by people who hate them, you know, for generations, and so they're 90% of their country are reservists, and so they can activate their reservists at any given time, and they did. I think they activated like 300,000 reservists after this attack, which is like a lot of people for a tiny country. Jerusalem's interesting. It's split up into quadrants, basically. And so each sector of the city belongs to a different faith. And it's like going to an airport. So you can go into the like the Christian section. And then if you want to go into the Muslim section, you have to go through like airport like security. So you don't bring in like bombs and stuff like that. And there's an Armenian, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, and Armenian. I think those are the four quarters. But when you look at like their religious monuments, they're all like overlapping in the same like area, which is why the lines are drawn really weird. Thousands and thousands of years. And obviously there's an ethnic angle to it. There's a religious angle to it. But at the end of the day, Hamas attacked Israel. Israel, how they chose to respond, I think, is where some of the rub comes in. And so it is possible to be, you know, against Hamas attacking Israel and also against the way that Israel is responding. That's, you can hold both of those beliefs at the same time. I'm a big proponent of that. In the first like 10 days, they dropped like 6,000 bombs across the Gaza Strip. And I don't know if that number's correct. That's what they claim. Not 6,000 pounds, not, it's 6,000 bombs. To put it in perspective, at the peak bombing of like Syria, which was a lot of airstrikes, that's like 2 months of bombings from the United States into Syria, and I did it in like a week. So if that number's true, I think they're inflating a little bit, but if that number is true, they don't have many weapons left. They can't. Like that's just, their stockpiles have to be like severely depleted. It's going to take them a long, long time to replenish the stockpiles. All the stockpiles, by the way, come from the United States. So whether it's guidance kits or the actual bomb bodies, we use military aid every year. We give them money and then they spend the money buying U.S. Defense technology. So it's an interesting cycle. And that's part of the $100 billion request at the White House, that supplemental request. Part of that was to replenish those stocks as we're starting to ship stuff back in to Israel.
What do you think the strategy is? If the number is true, if they have dropped 6,000 bombs, I mean, do you think it is just a pure reflexive strike back? We're just going to put everything we can on you because this was so horrific? Or do you think that there's another strategy involved?
First of all, it was an intelligence failure of epic proportions for a country who prides themselves on having pristine, accurate, sensitive intelligence of everyone around them. The second part is they probably had some intelligence of like, here are the known targets from like, you know, highest probability to lowest probability and highest priority to lowest priority. So they probably had, I would imagine they've had like all of these targets are kind of pre-planned and then just revalidated them over time for civilian population. The problem is that Gaza has like 2.2 million people and an estimated of about 30,000 Hamas terrorists, like fighters. Okay. To include the actor Gaza guy, which was hilarious at once on social media. Yeah.
We definitely got to talk about him.
Yeah, we'll talk about him. He's one of them. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is he one or is he like seven? Like, you know, are they pumping the numbers with this guy?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. So when you look at like there's 2.2 million people in the Gaza Strip, and that's why Israel had that evacuation order, like evacuate out of the north part of Gaza Strip. Because that's where they wanted to, I would imagine, where their border incursions are going to happen. They're going to go into the north based on probably their intel of where most of the point of origins were. Oh, by the way, they also have a crazy underground tunnel network. It's estimated to be 300 miles of tunnels underneath Gaza. For perspective, if you look at the New York City subway system, which is the largest subway system in the United States of tunnels, that's only 150 miles of tunnels. So as crazy as New York subway is, double that. That is the level of like burrowing underground. Obviously, they don't have subway cars going through it, but it's a wicked problem. And it works out to be like it's like 50 to 1, 71. I think it's like 70-1 ratio of like population to terrorists in this urban environment. That's crazy. Oh, and by the way, Gaza, that 2.2 million people, they're actually weird in that half of their population is under 18, which is a weird population dynamic to have. If you're listening to this pod and you live in the United States, we have like a 20% ratio. So 20% of our population is under 18, 50% of their population is under 18. It's a really interesting dynamic. So that's why you, on TV, the Gaza Strip, you see kids all over the place because there's kids all over the place. Yeah, but the Gaza man, you know, it goes back to the terrorists, right? They're going to do something. They want to make sure they can record it in a way. And if you looked at the way that social media happened, like instantly, they had the terrorists like with GoPros filming everything to like stream it out and get it out to get their message out, which is going to propagate like the damage that they're trying to elicit, right? It's terrorism. It's fear. And so it's carrying their message using social media. And there's a lot of obviously information and disinformation. The disinformation usually takes a while to distill, which is why it's really dangerous, which is one of the reasons like, hey, I'm just not going to post about this. I'm just going to like let it play out a little bit and then, you know, kind of go from there. But yeah, the Gaza guy, you had a post about him.
I did. Yeah. So first he posted celebratory videos with rockets screaming overhead out of Gaza into Israel. And then there's a post of him in tears crying as Israel has just bombed some building in the background. And then there's like a stylized post of him like waving an AK-47 in the air. And then there's a post of him in a hospital bed pretending to be a victim with a bunch of medical equipment connected to him, but all the equipment is turned off. Like nothing's actually happening. And then yesterday I saw yet another post where he's like celebrating in the street. I mean, he's all over the place.
He's the same guy. Like, yeah, it's the hospital one is where I think he jumped the shark. It's like, all right, man, like we should just stop paying attention to this guy. I mean, he's a very unique looking individual. So you can pick him out pretty instantly when you see him online. And yeah,
we've got like really distinctive facial hair. Like he's not even like shaving the beard, you know?
It's not like not even trying to cover it up to at least like some, you know, obfuscation or whatever. Like just like, hey, here's me. Here, you know, it's Tim, did you see that?
I did. Yeah. I think I saw Jake's post about it, but it was where he wasn't turned on or the equipment was or wasn't at the hospital. It's pretty crazy.
There's another video I saw of like a dead baby like wrapped in a blanket and then like the blanket sort of falls off and it's a doll that they're crying over, which is not to minimize the fact that there are civilian casualties in Gaza for sure. You cannot drop 6,000 bombs without killing civilians for no way, right? But a lot of what they're putting out there is total misinformation, which makes it really hard to tease out like what is actually going on. Like, how bad are the numbers of civilian casualties? Hamas, since they're the governing body of Gaza, which is crazy since they're a terrorist organization, but they are the official governing body. All the information that comes out of Gaza is from governmental organizations controlled by Hamas. So there we have like zero credibility, or there's like zero validity to any of the data they release, right? The IDF, on the other hand, are also incentivized to be lying about stuff.
Oh yeah, everything is tailored to suit a narrative on both sides, right? It's like the hospital bombing, great, perfect example. The quote hospital bombing that happened, and then I think it was the New York Times kind of went to press front page or whatever it was on their website about it, and then you know leave it to the internet to go like, well, where is the hospital? And like, oh, it's right here. Oh, actually, it was a parking lot. Like, okay, and like, what's the crater look like? And you start looking at it, like, wait a minute. Where did this thing come from? And then they finally found the footage of the salvo of rocket attacks, and they saw at night you can see one of them kind of like dithers out and kind of falls, and the line of sight of where it's falling is like almost directly correlated with where that parking lot was. Like chances are it was a rocket because it looks like a rocket crater, and you know where did the rocket come from? Like yeah, so
I mean, the rocket launch site, I guess, was a cemetery that is connected to the hospital or adjacent to the hospital. So, I mean, they're launching these rockets from the hospital, effectively.
I will give it to No, actually, I'm not going to give it to them. I'm not going to talk about their ingenuity and what they did. But tactically, like how they took down the Israeli intelligence to come across the border for their attacks, I think is it's a good example of how tactics can overcome technology if you're not prepared to kind of go through the pre-mortem of that. So they used quadcopters with grenades to basically fly over to these power stations and take out the power grids that were powering the remote sensing towers that were going to pick up when the people were coming across to know that there's a no man zone. I think it's like 100 yards or so of like a no-go zone around the wall. And so they have these automated towers that kind of sense all that. Well, if you take out the power in the sector, now the towers don't have power. Or they went and just bombed the tower with the same quadcopter, and then they take a bulldozer and ram the wall, and now the wall's open. Or you take the paragliders and just fly over the wall.
I think like an interesting angle here is the Second Amendment. Like, I've always been a proponent of more gun control in the U.S., but I think if you're going to make an argument against gun control, what Hamas did on 10/7 in Israel, I think is a great argument for a Second Amendment or Second Amendment freedoms, right? Almost everyone in Israel has done a stint with the IDF, right? It's compulsory service, so everyone is trained. I think I saw 2% of Israeli households actually own a firearm. It's really hard to get a permit to own a firearm in Israel. But if you watch a lot of this like early footage that came out from Hamas or some of it, a lot of it's hard to watch. The kibbutzes were unarmed, but you can imagine if all of the residents of the kibbutzes had been armed, Hamas wouldn't have done nearly as much damage as they had done, right? Like, it's one thing to go door to door and shoot a bunch of unarmed grandmas. It's another thing to go door to door and kill a bunch of grandmas that are armed with shotguns who have their grandkids hiding in the back.
I think Tim is probably on your side, having been a former owner of a gun store.
Yeah, I mean, and if you compounded even with our open border, right? I mean, how many people are coming through and what's happening? And, you know, I even saw it's probably propaganda on our part too, but, you know, the clips that are selective just fit a narrative. But, you know, the questioning of Secretary Mayorkas over there by in Congress, where they're, you know, he's getting a grilling about the app that's coming on. You just register for a time and then you show up and no questions asked, here you go, and then released back into the country, right? I'm sure that they're doing some sort of vetting and diligence and stuff behind that, but I mean, yeah, it's kind of crazy, right? Whenever you can think about the threat picture that's out there and the risk, right? And what the real life consequences could be. Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
And it gets even crazier. Two things. So first, Tim, your conspiracy theory about the timing of this. Did you know what happened on October 18th with Iran?
What are you referring to? I guess if you have some more context, but I don't think so.
Do you remember way back when in 2005, there was the Iran nuclear arms deal?
Okay.
There was a provision in that, and that was the restrictions on ballistic missile technology. That expired October 18th.
Okay. No, I wasn't tracking that at all.
Yeah, you didn't hear about it because things are going on in Israel. So what happened was the UN Security Council restriction was ended like that day. And as soon as it ended, the US launched its fresh set of sanctions, but they're unilateral, right? So only the US and Russia, like at the same time, they're like, you know, they're out there striking a deal to transfer ballistic missile technology to Iran the same day that it expires. And this is not the rest of the JCPOA. In 24 months, all of the nuclear restrictions go away. So Iran can actually resume all of their nuclear ambitions based on what we agreed to back in 2005.
It's kind of crazy, right? And then if you look at some of the choices that were made by former AFSOC commanders and getting rid of the forces that we have and the drawdowns based off of that pivot to the Pacific, we're definitely going to be in for some awesome chaotic times, right? Where we get to see some opportunities for, you know, innovation and all this other stuff that's going to happen, right? It's going to be pretty crazy to see what happens.
Well, we've already had more Iranian intervention in this conflict too, right? The U.S. carrier groups have been shooting down cruise missiles being fired by the Houthis in Yemen, but those missiles are coming from Iran, and the Houthis are funded by Iran. So there's no way they'd be shooting these missiles at Israel without permission.
And just to make it even crazier, because you can't make this stuff up, There's a lot of reports coming in based on what the material that's been landing in Israel or that has originated in Gaza, that a lot of those weapons are coming from North Korea. just to like make it even weirder, right? So they have RPGs, artillery, and there's been some video with them with North Korean anti-tank missiles. Like, where did all that come from? Turns out, like, North Korea does a lot of illicit arms sales to a lot of people, to include Hamas and Hezbollah. The largest shipment that's been, like, knowingly seized was 35 tons of weapons on a cargo plane. That was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But, like, someone's buying all their weapons. Like, well, there you go.
Yeah, all those sanctions that we've thrown around with foreign policy are working really well, right?
Well, sanctions are interesting. You know, there's a will, there's a way, whether it's like Iran or North Korea. I mean, the fact that they're able to, especially North Korea, they're able to do things with the amount of restrictions that they have is actually kind of fascinating. Just like, you know, human nature. I mean, good, bad, or ugly, it is what it is. But all right. So the last thing I want to talk about, and we'll shift. Do you guys know what the qualitative military edges? You guys ever heard of that?
Can't say I have.
You gotta learn something new right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, let's hear it.
All right, so QME is written into law in the United States. It's an amendment to the arms control policies that we have. And it basically says that the United States has to give Israel preferential treatment to our best weapons. And then they have to have a qualitative advantage over anything else in the region. This is why Israel gets F-35s and Saudi Arabia doesn't. By law, we have to give them better stuff. And then if we want to give someone in the region equipment parity, so we sell the same thing to two countries, for instance, we have to actually go through and make sure that it's okay with Israel to bless it. This is why when the F-35 was the UAE, they were trying to buy the F-35 back in 2020. They had to like work with Israel because of the qualitative military edge in law. And then the deal ended up falling apart a couple years later. So they didn't buy the F-35. But this is why like Israel has like a bunch of like top tier U.S. equipment, is because it's written into our export arms law. And then we give them about $3 billion a year in military aid to buy the stuff back from us. So it's a interesting dynamic.
It's wild. We haven't really gone deep into the conspiracy theories, but one of the other reasons for the timing of this that's been discussed is that the US is considering striking a defense pact with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is on the cusp of signing a, I don't know if it's a peace agreement or a non-aggression treaty or something with Israel, right? So they are working on an alliance of sorts, and Iran is opposed to that because they're mortal enemies of both Saudi Arabia and Israel. And I think the agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel is a trilateral agreement with the U.S. involvement as well, right? So I think one of the theories is that this attack was designed to elicit the response we've seen the IDF elicit, in order to derail the talks with Saudi Arabia, right? So just to keep the region divided, which seems like a pretty reasonable theory.
Yeah, you know, when we were in Iraq and Afghanistan, but in particular Afghanistan, there was a time where it's like, okay, like the best way to win this war has nothing to do with tactics and everything to do with strategy. And there was a saying that, you know, one bomb will never win the war in Afghanistan, but one bomb on the wrong target can certainly lose the war. And it's all about what is the public perception and what's the hearts and minds of the populace. And when Israel launched their airstrike counteroffensive, which was, again, the flurry of like the intensity and the density of those targets, I mean, you can't say that there's not going to be a lot of civilian casualties, right? And that's where I think it quickly lost them some winds out of their sails of, you know, the court of public opinion. And I think now you saw there's a lot of heads of state, to include President Biden and Secretary of State, flying to Israel to try to figure out, like, hey, how you respond right now is going to be what people remember. And so you have to be very, very deliberate of what you're doing. And then how does this end? If you're going to, hey, we're going to go and go into Gaza, like, well, what's the end look like? Like, don't ever get into a war unless you know how you're going to leave, right? That's like Colin Powell 101. It's really unclear. And I think maybe that's why there was a little bit of a pause. Like, how is this going to end? And back to your point about Israel and their narrative, you know, this attack like instantly unified their political parties, and they basically formally declared war the first time since 73. And now I say, okay, what is the end state of conditions look like? Is it the like removal of all the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip? Like, oh, that's probably a non-starter for like, you know, the world, for a whole bunch of reasons. That might kickstart a whole like regional theater war with multiple nations. So it's really interesting, like, what is the actual end state of the response to that? And I haven't seen any clarity on that. And I think that's what a lot of the world leaders are trying to pressure Israel into doing, is being very thoughtful about their next steps, because it's going to matter.
It's a pretty tough question, right? Like, I don't know how you answer it.
I am so glad I'm not in charge right now, because that feels like this. There's probably like one way that this works, and there's like 15 million ways it doesn't.
Bit of a tangent from the core topic here too, but the rise of anti-Semitism around the world has been pretty shocking, I think, in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's been crazy.
It's been crazy. And I'll say that I'm Jewish. I'm not a practicing particularly religious person, but I am in a couple of WhatsApp groups with hundreds of Jews who are talking about this set of events. One of the things that I find striking is that everyone is scared by the rise in anti-Semitism and like what they've seen on campuses in the US. Like, it is scary for this community for sure. But there's very little hate in the groups I'm in. Like, I haven't seen anyone say anything hateful about Palestinians or Arabs. Certainly plenty of hate for Hamas, the organization, but no like racial or religious hate at all. Not even in like the immediate aftermath of the terrorist attacks. And I wonder what the Palestinian groups, the equivalent, look like. Are they equivalently sort of anti bombings of Gaza without any sort of anti-Semitism, or is there sort of the religious and racial hatred on the other side? I'm only seeing one side of the story, but I've been frankly very surprised at how little there is of that in any of the groups I'm in, coming from the Jewish side of the equation.
I think most of the Palestinians by population are Sunni Muslims. I'm almost positive. And so that's their regional alliance with the Muslim countries around them is because of that. And obviously even the Muslims have their own, you know, factions and variations as well. And there are some Christians that actually live in Palestine. Small amount, but there are. Let's put a pin in that for the day, and let's talk about what's been going on in Washington, D.C. Tim wanted to jump on the next way to get us canceled, which is to talk about politics, domestic politics.
I don't know, another crazy stuff, right? I mean, it's great timing for the chaos around the world whenever our government is, was it first time in history they vacated the speaker? Right, or the
yeah,
chair.
But I also think because they changed the way that you could vacate a speaker, that made it like absurdly easy to do, which is part of the concessions that McCarthy like was elected under. He's like, hey, if you don't like me, you can vote me out. I'll make it easy to vote me out. I'll just change these you know, proceedings. And then they called him on it, right? So it's the first time in history because you made the bar low, right?
So that's been super interesting, right? I mean, the overall timing of, and I know we talked about this whenever he was first elected way back in like, I don't know, was it January or something, or maybe before, but you know, now that the government doesn't have the funding bills and the shutdown was going off, and then the CR that's coming through, and yeah, it's I wish that we could just figure out how to get our act together, right? Because it isn't doing anybody any favors.
I want to go with an opposite take on this, okay? Bear with me. We're going to have to suspend belief for just a minute. I think it was a great thing, and here's why. When they lowered the bar to remove him as the speaker, and that was the concession to get him elected, and then ultimately called him on it for not upholding the things that he had promised that he was going to do for the Tea Party or Tea Party-esque factions of the Republican Party. All of politics and legislation stops unless you have a speaker. Like, nothing is allowed to happen. Like, that is how it works. So you are going to sit there day in and day out until you find a speaker, and then you can resume order. And so, like, Congress can't do anything until it has a speaker. And so that became like, okay, well, let's get ourselves a speaker. Well, because the bar was so low to fire anyone, either no one wanted the job or there wasn't enough consensus to elect anyone to keep a job, because they were just going to get kicked out as soon as they got elected, right? So you had to have a plan of, like, why should we resume order in legislation in this legislative body unless we have, like, a clear path forward? So there was a lot of shenanigans that led up to his firing, and how it happened was obviously, like, a little bit of a political stunt. Not a big fan of that stuff, obviously. But when you look at the after action, so Mike Johnson is the speaker as we're recording this. He might get fired next week. Who knows? But right now he is the elected speaker of the House. He's from Louisiana, and he's actually coming from the House Armed Services Committee, so Subcommittee on Readiness and Sea Power Projection. So the speaker will usually, by precedent, vacates his positions on the committees, and he's the speaker full time. So he's not going to do that anymore. But here's where I think it's interesting. Like, the whole point of, like, everything falling apart had to come over with, like, spending. Like, everything was about spending, is because our, whether it's deficit spending and the national debt, and interest rates are pushing the debt crazy. And that's what's also making our deficit spending even crazier. And so you had to have someone who's like, how do we restore order? It's like, well, we got to get control over the spending. Like, well, how do you get control over the spending? We should, like, go back to, like, what we used to do was pass spending bills on their own instead of these omnibus, which is like, we're going to package them all together. And it's like, take it or leave it. And there's a lot of stuff, a lot of inefficient stuff. And there's I wouldn't say inefficient, but the way that it's split up is everything to do with power and politics, and nothing really to do with efficiency. I will say that there's 12 appropriations bills that fund the government. And this was set up in 75 or 76, 1976. In the time that policy went into place, do you know how many times that Congress since 1976 has passed all four bills or all 12 bills on time in a year?
Was it like two?
I'm going to say once.
Four. Four times. Nice. Ever.
Oh, I'm a pessimist. Look at this.
Yeah, four times since 1976. And, like, how do you think that that's going to work this time when it historically has never worked? The last time that Congress could do that was in 1997. And so what happened was they started using omnibuses to package them together to try to make it easier, which then they turned into a political weapon instead. So before, interestingly, so it goes back to appropriations. So 12 bills. You know why there's 12 appropriation bills to fund the United States?
Pass one every month?
Nope. Because there's 12 appropriation subcommittees, and those 12 appropriation subcommittees have staff, and those staff are organized with oversight of the things on their committees. And so the reason you have 12 bills is you have 12 committees of jurisdiction. Like, did there need to be 12? Could there be 10? Could there be less? In those committees, you have committee assignments, which are some of them are very prized assignments to be like Armed Services Committee or Appropriations, where you're voting on money. You have rigor and professional staff members, call them PSMs, that do that work. So when it goes to the floor, 95% of that work is done, and your offices in the House and the Senate are represented on the committees just by nature of being an elected member, right? So you do have a say. It's not like you don't have a say at all, and you don't have a chance to debate it on the floor. By the time it comes to the floor, it shouldn't really need a whole lot of debate. That's the whole point. So the fact that they want these single spend bills per committee introduced separately on the floor for debate, history is not on your side. But remember, I said this is good. Everything I said is bad, right?
Well, the debate is supposed to happen in the committees. Right. I mean, if you care about the farm bill, you should be on in the agricultural committee or whatever. I don't know what committee handles the farm bill, but that's what the debate's supposed to happen. If they're supposed to be the experts, that committee staff, those committee members, so that by the time it hits the floor, I mean, it should be more than 95%. It should be 99% of the work should be done by the people who actually care about that particular part of the government the most.
The good news is, or not, that we are in a continuing resolution, which means that because we're in fiscal year 2024 right now, with no approved budget from Congress, we have a continuing resolution that expires 17 November, which is in about 3 weeks from now as we're recording this. And so the plan is, what are you going to do? Are you going to vote for another CR? Or are you going to pass these bills? And so this is where the good news comes in. Remember I said there was good news in this? So one of the first things, and you can tell it's very deliberate, when Mike Johnson took over, have you seen his letter that he issued? It's great. It's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a 2-page memo. I've got it up on the screen right here so I don't screw it up. I'm not going to read it, obviously, the whole thing. But he basically says, like, we're going to restore order, and here's how we're going to do it. I mean, it's clear, it's succinct. It's like, on this week, we're going to introduce and vote on this spending bill. On this week, we're going to do this spending bill. And it goes, oh, by the way, there's just not enough time to vote on all of the spending bills before the CR that we have right now expires. So, and he has, like, we will vote on a CR and go ahead and preemptively extend it into this date or this date, depending on some conditions. And we were going to vote through all these spending bills. And he has a, hey, and from October, November, here's my 6 steps. In December, here's the 3 things that have to happen. In January, here's what we're going to do. And it's like month by month, step by step, here's how we're going to restore order. I'm like, this is great. We'll see how, you know, what happens to it. And a lot of it is like, it's not just, hey, we're going to throw stuff into the Senate. It's like, we're going to give so much time that the Senate is not going to be able to put pressure back on the House to pressurize them to approve something. This is going to be done in a very bipartisan, deliberate manner, although, you know, with debate. But everything in Congress is a compromise anyways. But I thought this is really, really great. What a great example of political leadership at a time that I think that D.C. really could use some leadership. That's not about just party lines, but like, hey, let's restore order for why everyone's here in the first place was to govern and to legislate the land to make sure we're representing our people. Then we can, you know, fight over your ideals versus political party and, you know, how you identify left, right, center, which is the last thing. Like his last, the last bullet on his note, second to last, it's of all of his point by things. Once we've done all of that, in all caps, it just says expand our majority, period. So restore order, and then you can go back to being political.
It sounds like a phenomenal plan, but, you know, as Mike Tyson once said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. So what's going to happen? I guess we'll see if he gets punched in the face or if he's able to wrangle his caucus to get this done.
I mean, yeah, like he's... I mean, he's already behind. the letter was dated October 23rd, and it has like the energy and water appropriations the week of the October 23rd. So we're recording this on a Friday of that same week, and I didn't check Twitter or anything before we started the pod whether that actually got voted on or not, but it'd be fascinating if it was, but I don't know if it has been. It's already behind the first week. Not a good sign.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, right, I think that's probably the silver lining is that for the defense budget, it's going to be real hard not to pass it politically, to have troops go and deploy for this crazy conflict that's happening and, you know, not have paychecks and a budget and all this other stuff for us to operate within. So, I fully expect, you know, the CR to go through again or something along those lines, because, I mean, it'd be really, really, politically expensive to try to stand against it now.
Yeah. And someone's going to have to pay, by the way, we're deploying all these troops. That's an extra bill. That's not accounted for in this budget either. We had OCO. And then before that we had the GWAT fund. It was this extra pot of money for keeping people in the Middle East, 'cause it costs a lot of money. That doesn't exist anymore. So some point, someone down the road is going to have to pay the bill for the military forces being moved right now. Speaking of money, let's end Congress. Let's talk about Jake. You put your name on a document that went to Congress, right?
Did I do that? I guess I did.
What are you, like, Urkel?
I did do that. Can I do that? No, we signed. We're one of a number of venture firms and startups that signed a letter urging Congress to fund DIU the way I think the House Appropriations Committee first proposed funding DIU, which is to basically give them somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion to implement what DIU is calling the hedge strategy. And that is to invest in and purchase small, attritable, diverse platforms to accomplish the DoD's goals. So for those not paying super close attention, that would be like, instead of buying one F-35, let's go out and buy 400 small UAS systems that are much less capable, but in the aggregate can accomplish a similar mission set.
So that was something, right? It was in the House Appropriations Bill, but then it got stripped or didn't get included in the Senate or something like that, right? Got taken out in conference, or do you know what happened?
The Senate is not as bullish on DIU in general, is my understanding.
But do they have a conference version of that legislation? You know? I actually don't know.
I haven't seen it. Yeah, I don't know.
Last I heard, it was taken out. So that section was actually taken out, I guess. But it was something that, if I'm not mistaken, right, that Nate Diller, the guy from AFWERX, right, was turned into a PSM, and then, you know, that was helping champion that stuff through.
Speaking of PSMs, I was in DC maybe a month ago for a meeting with a group of PSMs on another topic. I was mostly there to answer questions for them, but at the end, I got to ask a few questions of my own. And I would say that the general feeling in the room is that they are unhappy with the number of new defense innovation initiatives that are springing up, and that those initiatives sometimes are at cross purposes or overlap one another, and maybe are there more as statement pieces of new folks who are in the building or in positions who want to be able to say, I did that thing, than they are because they're really necessary. So I think the gestalt of the meeting was that maybe we should be paring back some of these programs, not necessarily because they wanted to cut, I think, the amount of money going to the programs, but wanted to start consolidating lines of control and rationalizing the way we're doing innovation and defense. That was the feeling I got. And I think that's not a misguided feeling coming from the PSMs. So I think there's some of that going on in terms of, you know, pushback on DIU getting $1 billion. It's also true, you know, DIU has been complaining for a long time that they've been woefully underfunded. And that is 100% true. I don't know what they were funded at last year, but I think it was on the order of like $50 million. And so there's a legitimate
pennies.
As to whether or not you can basically go from a $50 million organization to a $1 billion organization in, you know, like that. Because remember, money that Congress appropriates, it has to be spent in the year it is appropriated. So it's not like they're given $1 billion to then sit mostly and think about how are we going to think about investing this money and spending it over time. You can correct me in a second, Mike. But if you drop $1 billion on someone's desk and say, deploy this money, like, do they have the infrastructure the day that money drops on their desk to deploy it in a way that's smart? So I think some of the pushback in Congress is probably related to speed of scaling for DIU.
I just did some research on this, so maybe this is where there's an idea. So the Defense Production Act, Title III, right? And there's a fund for that. So you could do some above the threshold reprogramming on the DIU budget and get it sent over there. And then once it's into that fund, it actually never expires. But it, you know, there'd have to be a lot of politics and stuff. And there's obviously tremendous oversight for that. But I don't know. What do you think, Mike?
Man, there's so much to unpack there. So an ATR, an above threshold request to reprogram, that requires all committees of jurisdiction to approve it. So the Pentagon goes, hey, I want to put extra money into DIU. And if it's above a certain amount of money, and it changes every few years what that is, say it's like $25 million. That number sticks in my mind for some reason. So say they had money they want to give DIU. Well, they can't just give it to DIU. They have to go to Congress. Or if it's different colors of money, there's ways to do it. And the House Armed Services, the House Appropriations Subcommittee for Defense, the Senate Armed Services, and the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee for Defense all have to agree And so getting all of them to agree when they have varying opinions on a lot of things is sometimes not easy. And you don't want to flood Congress, because it's the entire Department of Defense has to do this procedure. So you're very judicious when you send things over to try to get, you know, changes from what Congress originally appropriated the money for. So it's something that they take very seriously. I mean, there's like something like 3,000 line items in the budget, and they're all individually like put money in, and there's a lot of politics behind each one of those line items. And so when you move money around those line items, people tend to get a little squirrely about it. So, but yeah, technically you can do it. The hedge fund's interesting. I saw someone, I don't know if you guys saw it on LinkedIn. I was just scrolling the other day, and someone's like, I don't understand this billion-dollar hedge fund. Why are we giving all this money to prop up these defense startups? None of them are profitable. I'm like, first of all, it's not a hedge fund. It's a hedge portfolio. You're not investing in companies. You're buying their stuff. And the stuff you're supposed to buy is a hedge against all the traditional acquisitions that are, guess what? They arrive like too bloated, too late, and too expensive. So we never buy enough of it. It's the hedge against that. Instead of putting all your bets into the same thing you've been doing the past 30 years, it's like, just take $1 billion, which sounds like a lot of money. I know. But when you're talking about an $870 billion budget, it's like, what, less than 1%, right?
Well, less than 1%.
Yeah.
Well, less
than 1%. Like 0.5%. And we're going to take, you know, 99.5% of the budget and do like, you know, the same thing we've always done. Guess what? Nothing's going to change. We're going to take this 0.5% and do something different and see how it works out for maybe a couple years, right? That doesn't seem like that big of a stretch. Now, to your point about like innovation and organizations, yeah, there's a lot of innovation theater going on. The details matter though, right? So when you actually look at like how innovation happens, how disruptions happen, do you know how Apple, for instance, like pretty innovative company, do you know how it innovates? Do you guys know how?
No.
There's only two ways that large organizations innovate. Right.
I mean, they can buy stuff, right?
They buy innovation, or they establish a separate business unit in their business to do the innovation for them, because large organizations do not innovate. Like, there's hundreds of studies over the past 50 years that all say the same thing. Like, it's human nature. Bureaucracy sets in, process sets in, you have decision paralysis or by consensus, it doesn't happen. So, you know, Apple they were at a clip of buying like 30 companies a year for a while. And that's how they were getting a lot of their innovations. You know, a lot of the innovations from Microsoft were bought. They didn't build it. You know, they didn't even build DOS. Most of the stuff they're famous for, like, they didn't build PowerPoint. They bought it from, it was actually an Apple product, and they converted it to a Windows-based product. But yeah, so when you look, there's hundreds and hundreds of examples. There is a line there of like, who is the innovation unit for the Department of Defense? Interestingly, by title, that would be the Defense Innovation Unit. By charter, it is not, right? It's not funded to do it. It doesn't have the right authorities yet to do it. And it can't, there's a Goldilocks there. They need to get bigger, but not too big, right? And who's coordinating all these efforts across the department? Innovation's a weird thing. If only we had the head of DIU on here to interview.
Oh, Mr. Beck, we'll get him. I think there's a good argument actually to be made for creating new innovation groups in the DoD because of what you just touched on, Mike. And that is, at some point, the innovation groups themselves become ossified and they're no longer innovative, right? They sort of outlive their purpose. And like, part of the mechanism there is that when DIU was first started, for instance, it was started by a bunch of insurgents, right? Who had an interesting idea about how the DoD could be or should be engaging Silicon Valley more aggressively. They got that done, and they did it in concert with Secretary of Defense Ash Carter at the time. Over time, all of those people then leave and go elsewhere. And so the people who come in, some of them are innovative change makers, but some of them might end up being clock punchers, for lack of a better term, right? People who are just moving somewhere else in the bureaucracy. And so it starts to look more and more like the rest of the bureaucracy over time. I'm not saying that's happening with DIU, but I think it's a natural evolution for organizations. So there's an argument to be made 10 years from now, maybe we will need something, a new DIU, because DIU won't have been able to keep that culture alive. I don't know. But for now, I think it's a great organization. It needs to be funded better. So,
yeah, two things on that real quick. There is a powerful thing that happens, especially within the Department of Defense, when you can align accountability, resources, and authority at the same unit, the same level, specifically the same person, powerful things happen. It's so rare that those three things rest on a single organization, which is why like so much stuff doesn't happen. So if DIU had the accountability to deliver like, actual like deliver results, like specific, like solve this problem in the next 24 months. Like this is the problem that, you know, the Secretary of Defense said, so these are the three problems you must solve in the next 24 months. You are accountable. I'm going to give you $1 billion to do it. So he's got the resources and then execute here. What you pick the team, and instead of hiring like GSs or assigning, you know, active duty, depending on them, because they rotate, you can hire your own team and we'll pin them as highly qualified experts, HQEs, which is a mechanism that does exist. So the Pentagon can bring in people from industry to help. There's a little bit of double dipping that happens. It could happen. So there's obviously some fences you got to put up, but none of this is hard. It's just navigating the bureaucracy. So the people who can navigate the bureaucracy best in a bureaucracy win, right? That's the game. It's the game in the game. But if you can align those three things, like powerful things happen. When I was in the Air Force, we used to go out to WEPTAC, the Weapons and Tactics Conference, which is like the biggest event of the year. It happens at Nellis, home of the fighter pilot. 2,000 to 3,000 of the smartest tacticians in the world get together for a couple weeks. They go, here are the problems that need to be solved. And these people come up with a fascinating, like, hey, we could do this, we could do that. And there's some things like, you know, I could do this, but if I had like two pennies to rub together and I just changed this one thing on this thing that already exists, we could do this other thing with it and it would solve this like strategic problem. And instead of going like, hey, where's the organization that has those two pennies to rub together to solve that problem? Who has those three things, right? Accountability, resource, responsibility. No one. And so they're like, no, I'm sorry. You can't actually spend two pennies to solve that problem. Like, well, I can't tactic my way out of a strategic problem that the four-star generals created because of just, you know, acquisitions and requirements and all the stuff. So it's an interesting problem.
It's the classic principal agent problem, right? And I think the DoD is rife with those problems and sort of across the spectrum. But it's like, if I can spend $10 from my budget and save someone else $100, but that's their budget, not my budget, can I do it? Probably not, right? Because we don't have balancing across budget line items. Or at least I'm not willing to do it. I'm not willing to spend my $10 to save you $100, even though we're theoretically all on the same team.
Yep, that's like it's like SBIRs, like small business, right? They're funded by the Small Business Association, managed through, I think, like in the Air Force, like AFWERX authorities through that. But there's no like PEO connection. Who's the executive, the program executive officer, who's actually making the acquisition decisions? He's like, he's completely divorced from it. It's like, where's the PEO in the SBIR phase two connection? Like, where's your, like, so he knows what's going on and how it can and help him in his portfolio. And like, oh, yeah, they don't talk. Like, well, you know, that's why your transition record is terrible, right? Same thing with like R&D labs. Like, when you can talk commercial versus government R&D investment, you know, 30 years ago, that flipped, right? It's 80% commercial, 20%, you know, government. But the government still pretends like their funding is going to like change the world. And for certain things, you know, that are specifically military, I mean, that's good. But a lot of it exists out in the commercial sector. Again, DIU is created to try to solve this. A lot of capital out there. It's just, we're still thinking it's like 30 years ago. Crazy. Man, I've been on a rant all day today, haven't I? God.
No, man, you have. Good. It's almost like you don't like the way the government operates. I'm getting the sense from you.
It's a great government. It's great. It does a lot of great things.
It's the best you got.
It ain't bad. As much as I complain about it, it ain't bad. There's a lot of good stuff about it. So I'll give you a choice here. I've been going for about an hour here. We can talk about Replicator Or Tim wanted to talk about his experience with the TacFi StratFi.
I got 10 minutes and then I got to bounce.
TacFi StratFi. All right. Here we go. Tim, what happened lately with you? You were working this and you were like, damn it, this sucks.
Yeah, man. So this is one of those, you know, really grinds my gears kind of thing. So if you're involved with AFWERX, please listen up. If you know anybody at AFWERX, make sure that they hear this. I think it's really important that we communicate to the folks that are acting as the front door for the Air Force and for the innovation ecosystem and integrating small businesses and transitioning their technologies, is that we have to understand that you are a pivotal like cog in the strategy to combat China's military civil fusion strategy. Like, it is your role to then make it easy for small businesses to want to do business with the government. And I don't necessarily know that that's getting across the finish line here. You know, for example, StratFi's this year, TacFi's, you got a company who may, I mean, the life or death of the company may depend on getting this submission in and making sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. And now you got to hand over this package to a government person to submit the package on behalf of the small business, I think is a recipe for disaster. And then you compound that with the fact that the people that create the app sheet that you submit this stuff in don't have the attention to detail. You have questions in the templates that are asked in the affirmative, like, hey, are you executing or have you executed on a sequential phase two? The answer is no, right? Because it's a disqualifying question. But then you go to submit this thing, which, by the way, the company isn't submitting. It's this government person now. And it says, is the company not on a sequential phase two? So you're then asking these questions in the negative. So no, the company's not on a sequential phase two, because that would be disqualifying. And we're creating these things. And it's explicitly on page 6 of the app sheet. But it's like you're creating an unnecessary environment of stress and challenges. And just through a lack of attention to detail and an unwillingness to go above and beyond to make sure that it's easy for these founders and technologists and investors to want to work with the government. And if we're going to win, if you're going to compete against China and you're going to close the OODA loop so that you can actually interact with these companies, work with them and build high trust relationships, we really, really need to make sure that we got our act together, right? And the way we're doing it right now is not it. So that's my rant. Happy to talk. I don't know, but I'll be quiet now.
So TacFi, StratFi, real quick, tactical funding increase, TacFi, and strategic funding increase, StratFi. So that's a private-public pairing of money. That's why it's not a contract. It's an increase. And so there's different amounts. TacFi is less, StratFi is more. That's why it's strategic. So I think it caps out at 15 million right now, 20 million.
Yeah. So you can get 15 from the cyber money, and then you can do defense only or commercial. And there's varying, you know, ratios and proportions there.
So you have to basically bring money to the table. So you have to go out and find money from an investor, whether it's PE or VC, or you have, you know, capital assets and you can bring to match these increases. So it's a one-to-one match, for instance. And so the government is getting a higher return on their investment because they're asking the company to bring private capital, which is probably dilutive, to the table to make this thing happen. And to your point, you're taking on a lot of risk with this thing, which could, you know, tank your whole company as a small business. You're really making it hard to people to want to do this, right? There's enough terrible ways to do business with the government, especially the Department of Defense. Like, this doesn't have to be one of them, guys. It really doesn't.
I mean, the StratFi program itself, the concept is great because it requires, it's government grant dollars. It's non-dilutive. Phenomenal. It requires private capital, which is some validation that there's a market for the thing you're building, some outside interest. So, you know, it's not just a government boondoggle. And then it also, they changed the rules periodically. The last time I looked at the program, it also required an actual government customer. So not someone who's just giving you OPM, other people's money, which is what the the CBER grant is, but some DoD customer saying, okay, we'll also cut you a $15 million check to buy your thing. So there's like some indication of real government interest in your product or DoD interest. And I assume that is still the case.
This is why when I see TACFI, StratFi announcements, they catch my attention because they've typically have been vetted both by the government from the Department of Defense and private industry to actually secure the capital to do that. So whenever I see them, it definitely catches my attention and I put those companies on my radar. And this is why I report on them a lot in the merge.
I always look to see who the government customer is. Who's putting up the real dollars, not the cyber dollars, but the real dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good to see the correlation between words and behavior, right? To make an investment decision. But I mean, I will give AFWERX credit and to their processes and things that they were doing. Like, you know, once the StratFi window closed and the submissions were in, they did give companies an opportunity to go back and change things and, you know, correct errors if there were things that were, you know, caught in the initial scrub kind of stuff. So definitely want to give props to them on that. But they could have advertised that. They could have, you know, told companies, hey, you know, there's going to be an initial screen. We can have a chance to do this. But it was literally like every single click on that app is a life or death decision potentially for your company for disqualification on this thing. And maybe that's speaking in an extremist, right? But we got to start off on the right foot and build high trust relationships with these companies that we say that we need, if that's in fact really what we believe.
So the good news is that, you know, AFWERX is continuing to evolve and iterate on themselves in the process. So I, in my day job, do interact with AFWERX on a few different projects. And I will say that their heart and minds are in the right place and they're all trying to do the right thing too. So hey, if you work at AFWERX and you should probably take a look at that form for your TACFI StratFi. I don't think it's out of ignorance. It could just be out of lack of like empathy of the situation that the people that are filling these forms out are in.
I was at a conference recently where there was a senior Air Force official, not someone related to AFWERX, on a panel. And this person said they thought that the Valley of Death was a good thing. And I think what they were trying to get at was that the department wants to work with great companies building great technologies. And the fact that some companies don't cross the chasm, or most companies don't, is okay because we want to work with the companies that can survive the gauntlet. But I think what they don't understand is that so many companies die in the Valley of Death for reasons that are totally capricious and arbitrary. Like they clicked the wrong box. It's not because the technology isn't the best technology out there, or the company isn't the most promising, the team isn't the best capability for dollars spent, whatever it is. But companies die randomly because of shitty DoD process. And like that's not a Valley of Death to be celebrated, right? That is a Valley of Death to be filled in.
Yeah, it's not a Valley of Death. It's like a, you know, World War One trench warfare, running across no man's land and like hoping for the best, right? Like, yeah, there's right, like that one valley. Yeah. There's a lot of bad stuff in that statement of good stuff. Like, yeah, not everything should succeed. There's a lot of terrible, terrible CBER contracts that I see of like, this thing's not going to go anywhere. It's so misaligned with every stakeholder and it doesn't even make any sense. But, you know, it's small business. You're going to fund it. I mean, that CBER was not invented to solve government problems. I'm going to go ahead and say it. It was invented to keep small business alive in the 80s. It was not there to actually solve problems for the warfighter, okay?
You're not saying this isn't a jobs program? No.
It was not invented to solve warfighter problems. There, I said it out loud. I said the quiet part out loud. Now, it could be adapted to do that, but that requires some changes. And so TACFI, StratFi is one of those things that could be very, very compelling, which is why I keep track of it. But, you know, fix the form and things will be better. Jake, you're about out of time. You got to go. You have a circus to go to, I think.
I have a circus to go to. I've got to go take my daughter to the circus.
Well, then we're going to leave it at that. Jake's going to go to the circus take his daughter to circus school. She's going to go train at the circus. All right. So that's it. Like, follow, and subscribe. Do what you got to do. If you have feedback, which I'm sure you guys do, because this has been a little bit of a spicy episode. Good. Throw some comments on the YouTube channel, and we'll read them all. And do your thing. And that's it. We're out. See ya.